I wondered how informed those who were making these decisions truly were. I always wondered about a lot of the agendas that were being worked. How political was this?
In Washington, a blunt lesson in the politics of harsh interrogations was unfolding. On December 17, 2002, the head of the Naval Criminal Investigative Service took the troubling reports he had received to the Navy's top civilian lawyer.
He came to me and, without prior warning or announcement, said that his people down in Guantanamo had reported to him that detainees were being abused.
One of Alberto Mora's great uncles had been imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp. Another was tortured before he was hanged.
And he felt that the abuse was serious, that it most probably violated American law and certainly violated American values, that his men were upset at being associated with this, and did I want to know more.
It was everything that he didn't believe in. And he sat there, still, listening, didn't ask a question for minutes. We all finished. And that's then, you know, when I remember him saying, this is not right.
Mora was shown the action memo Rumsfeld had approved and portions of Al-Qahtani's interrogation log. For 48 of 54 consecutive days, the prisoner would be questioned from 4 a.m. until midnight.
0400 hours. Detainee was told to stand, and loud music was played to keep detainee awake. Was told he can go to sleep when he tells the truth.
Doctors kept his body functioning well enough for the interrogation to continue.
2000 hours. Corman checks vitals and finds the detainee's pulse is unusually slow. 2050 hours. Heartbeat is regular, but very slow. 35 beats per minute.
Medically close to death, Al-Qahtani was rushed to the hospital where he was revived. And then, less than 2 days later, released.
1800 hours. Detainee is hooded, shackled, and restrained in a litter for transport to Camp X-Ray. 1830 hours. Detainee arrives at Camp X-Ray and is returned to interrogation booth.
Alberto Mora, General Counsel, U.S. Navy, 2001 through 6.
I was horrified. I was stupefied. I was astonished that this could have taken place, that Secretary Rumsfeld himself would have been asked, much less gotten involved in these kinds of matters.
He took his concerns to the author of the action memo, Rumsfeld's top lawyer, Jim Haynes.
I told him, Jim, this could be torture, and he instantaneously responded, no, it's not. And then I said, think through a little bit more carefully as to each of these techniques, light and auditory stimulus deprivation. What does that mean? You put them in a completely dark room for an hour, a day, a week, a month, until the person goes blind, until madness sets in, phobia techniques. What is that? The rats, the bats, the snake, a coffin? When and how? And when I left, I was convinced that he would be picking up the phone, calling the secretary and saying, boss, I made a mistake. We need to reel back something that we need to think through a little more carefully.
Join us in the countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Mora left Washington for the holidays, certain his intervention would succeed. He did not yet fully grasp that the abuses at Guantanamo were not the result of a lawyer's mistake, but of policy set at the highest level. in the Gambia in West Africa, far from Washington and the battlefield in Afghanistan. The great-grandson of a former prime minister of Jordan had been arrested when he arrived from London on a business trip. Bishr al-Rawi was held by Gambian authorities for a month until December 8, 2002.
Two Gambian agents, they sort of stand me up and we start walking. And boom, two big guys grab me and start dragging me up.
The two big guys were Americans. Al-Rawi had been swept up in a covert CIA program to nab suspects and move them to countries where they would be interrogated outside the law. Like hundreds of men abducted in so-called extraordinary renditions, Al-Rawi was good to go in just 20 minutes. Trussed like an animal and surrounded by American agents, he was loaded onto a Gulfstream jet bound for one of the CIA's secret black sites. Throughout the entire flight, I was on the verge of screaming. I was terrified. Near Kabul, in Afghanistan, in the dead of winter, Al-Rawi was thrown into an unheated underground cell. Unknown numbers of men, some who ended up in Guantanamo, others who have since disappeared, were held in what they themselves called the Prison of Darkness.
The words of Binyamin Mohammed, detainee 1458.
They hung me up. I was allowed a few hours of sleep on the second day, and then hung up again, this time for 2 days. My wrists and hands had gone numb. After a while, I felt pretty much dead. I didn't feel I existed at all.
The occasional beam from a guard's flashlight was all that pierced the dark and frigid cells.
Bishr al-Rawi, detainee 906.
You do not know what you're losing, like, you know, not being able to see. You have to use your senses, yeah, all over. It was a very, very difficult place to handle.
It was, one prisoner said, as if you were inside a tomb. Except for the sound. Speakers in every cell blasted nonstop around the clock for days that turned into weeks.
We're talking about never essentially being allowed to ever fall asleep soundly.
Brent Mickham was Bishr al-Rawi's pro bono American attorney.
So that, you know, you get to the point where you will say anything to try and be allowed to get some sleep. And what everyone has told me, they have no idea what they may have said. I mean, you're just not lucid. I mean, they could ask, you know, did you assassinate George Bush? And they would say, yeah.
When he arrived in the light and heat of Guantanamo, al-Rawi assured other prisoners that the worst was over.
That hope, you know, that's a human hope, natural hope, that, you know, gosh, maybe it's going to get better. Unfortunately, every time you think it's going to get better, it was getting worse.
In early January 2003, in a move guaranteed to be reported straight to the vice president's office, and so at considerable risk to his career, Alberto Mora drafted a memo calling the tactics still being used at Guantanamo at a minimum cruel and unusual treatment, and at worst, torture. On January 15th, he told Jim Haynes that if the interrogations were not halted, he would sign the memo, exposing the administration's policy.
Jim pushed the memorandum back at me in its envelope and said, I don't know what you're trying to accomplish with this, which was an astonishing comment. And then he said, well, I'm happy to inform you that the secretary is considering rescinding his authorities. So I said, considering. And then he said, I know. Let me get back to you.
To defuse the growing rebellion inside the Pentagon, Rumsfeld did suspend approval of the harshest tactics. And he asked the military's top lawyers to weigh in on interrogations, a year after the first prisoners had arrived at Guantanamo.
Major General Thomas Romig.
We only had one conversation with Mr. Rumsfeld. He came in and gave us a pep talk and basically said, this is so important and what you're doing will affect the United States for years to come. And it was a little strange that we were getting a pep talk on something like this. Maybe it was an attempt to get us to do what they wanted to do politically.
In fact, Jim Haines had already turned to the War Council's reliable scribe, John Yoo. And Yoo wrote an 81-page legal opinion expanding the still-secret torture memo. He now added, for example, that the president had the authority to approve tactics that could include drugging a prisoner, as long as the drugs did not create a profound disruption, substantially interfering with his cognitive abilities or fundamentally altering his personality. And that to violate U.S. law against maiming, cutting, biting, slitting must be specific to the body part the statute specifies, the nose, ear, lip, tongue, eye, or limb. Alberto Mora asked John Yoo to meet him in the Pentagon.
And as he was talking, I was becoming more concerned and more alarmed, and ultimately I asked him the question, well, John, does this mean that the president has the authority to order torture? And he said, yes.
Yoo's memo pushed even further, opining that anyone prosecuted for following the president's orders would be legally protected.
There isn't a court internationally or in the United States that would support that theory. If you've committed a act of torture or war crime, but because you believe you're operating under the umbrella of presidential war powers, the commander-in-chief's war powers, you're immune. The commander-in-chief doesn't have the power to make that which is illegal under the law of war legal.
But Jim Haines ordered a report based on John Yoo's assertions.
Jim Haines invited me to speak to him privately as to my thoughts. I said, if I were you, I'd put this in a desk drawer, never let it see the light of day again. Just let it go away.
I was told that, you know, we're not going to go forward on it. Everything's on hold. You've been listened to, and many of those techniques that were at the extreme end are now out the window.
We thought we had won. The word from Guantanamo was that the abuse of prisoners had stopped.
In fact, they had lost, and they had been deceived. The top military lawyers would not find out for more than a year that in April 2003, Rumsfeld had secretly given the go-ahead to use 24 harsh interrogation techniques at Guantanamo. General Miller was briefed. Interrogators at the prison camp had their own golden shield, immunity from prosecution, in advance.
I looked down the hall and I heard this headbanger music blaring out, and I could see what appeared to be like strobe light coming out of the doorway.
Colonel Stuart Couch, a military prosecutor who had gone through SEER training as a Marine, visited the prison camp to hear evidence on a case he'd been assigned.
And so I walked down the hallway, and the door was open. And I saw a detainee sitting on the floor. He was shackled. And the room was blacked out with the exception of this strobe light. And he was rocking back and forth. It looked, for all the world, like an experience that I had had going through SEER school. You know, the strobe lights and the heavy metal music. I mean, that was right out of the SEER school playbook. There was an Air Force attorney that was accompanying me, giving me the tour. And I just said, "Did you see that?" And he goes, "Well, yeah." And I said, "You know, I got a problem with that." And he goes, "Well, you know, that's approved."
Colonel Couch was not the only one troubled by the tactics Secretary Rumsfeld had approved. FBI agents at the prison camp were keeping what they called a war crimes file, noting what they witnessed.
I entered interview rooms to find a detainee chained hand and foot in a fetal position to the floor with no chair, food, or water. Most times they had urinated or defecated on themselves and had been left there for 18, 24 hours or more. On another occasion, the temperature in the unventilated room was probably well over 100 degrees. The detainee was almost unconscious on the floor, with a pile of hair next to him. He had apparently been literally pulling his own hair out throughout the night.
A detainee said a female interrogator, after not getting cooperation from him, called four guards into the room. While the guards held him, she embraced the detainee from behind and put her hand on his genitals. And she wiped what he thought was menstrual blood from her body on his face and head.
I mean, we were basically shackled to the floor, sitting like this, shackled to the floor. And you'd be sitting there. It seems like it was an experiment just to see to what extent they can take a human.
We have recreated our enemy's methodologies in Guantanamo. It will hurt us for decades to come. Decades.
Malcolm Nance, Chief of Training, U.S. Navy SEER, 1997 to 2008.
Our people will all be subjected to these tactics because we have authorized them for the world now. How it got to Guantanamo is a crime, and somebody needs to figure out who did it, how they did it, who authorized them to do it, and shut it down, because our servicemen will suffer for years.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
Three months after President Bush declared the end of major combat operations in Iraq, a potent guerrilla resistance rose across broad swaths of the country. Demands for real-time battlefield intelligence grew urgent. The gloves are coming off, interrogators were told in August 2003. Prisoners needed to be broken. One interrogator suggested
a baseline interrogation technique that at a minimum allows for physical contact resembling that used by SEER instructors. Sleep deprivation, fear of dogs and snakes appear to work nicely. I firmly agree that the gloves need to come off.
In In late August, on orders from the Secretary of Defense, Major General Jeffrey Miller traveled to Baghdad and told the general in charge of U.S. prison operations he was there to Gitmoize the interrogations. Rumsfeld arrived too and toured the American prison installed in what had been the heart of darkness during Saddam Hussein's regime, Abu Ghraib. 8 days later, interrogation techniques that mirror those Rumsfeld had authorized in Guantanamo were authorized for Iraq. These are exclusive photographs of a prisoner at Abu Ghraib and handwritten instructions taped outside his cell. He will be deprived of sleep, kept in stress positions, interrogated in the middle of the night. It is clear evidence of treatment that violates the Geneva Conventions, even as the administration claimed Geneva was being honored in Iraq. Behind the razor wire at Guantanamo, detainee number 760, Mohamedou Slahi, had become another focus of intense attention in Washington.
I mean, Slahi just jumped off the page. This guy is one of the most serious guys that we've got in Guantanamo.
Colonel Stuart Couch had been assigned to prosecute Mohamedou Slahi.
I did see information from other, from a high-value detainee that indicated he knew at least three of the hijackers that were integral to the 9/11 attack. That's what got my attention. That's what got the attention of just anybody that was familiar with Slahi's case.
Throughout the summer and fall of 2003, Slahi was the subject of a special interrogation plan approved by Secretary Rumsfeld. His diary describes what happened.
I was very hurting, for my hands were locked to the floor, and I could not stand. Mary was touching me with her sexual parts all over and talking dirty. I am not willing to talk in details about that ugly happen.
Intelligence information from Slahi's interrogation suddenly began to flood Stu Couch's desk.
I've been so long in segregation. I had been counting the holes of the cage I was in. There are about 4,100 holes.
Got in the back of my mind what I'd seen on that first trip, and I'm thinking, okay, why is he being this prolific? What's going on? You know, is it physical coercion?
Besides the physical coercion, an interrogator posing as a Navy captain sent by the White House told Slahi that his family was in danger if he didn't cooperate, that his mother had been in prison, and implied she might be raped in custody.
If you tell me that Slahi gave up information because you told him and showed him in a letter that you're bringing his mother to Guantanamo and that she could be abused by men, is anything that he tells you from that point, you know, is that credible?
If you are ready to buy, I am selling, I said. I tried my best to make myself look as bad as I could, and that exact way, you can make your interrogator happy.
Slahi's interrogation, Colonel Couch concluded, had been morally repugnant. He refused to prosecute.
God means what he says, and you know, we were created in his image, and we owe each other a certain level of dignity, a certain level of respect, and that's just a line we can't cross. We compromise our own ideals as a nation, then These guys have accomplished much more than driving airplanes into the World Trade Center and into the Pentagon.
When the abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib was exposed in April 2004, the administration tried to direct attention away from the question of torture. Blame was pointed toward the young MPs.
I shared a deep disgust that those prisoners were treated the way they were treated. Their treatment does not reflect the nature of the American people. That's not the way we do things in America. And so I didn't like it one bit.
But there are the photographs. Images that portray tactics earlier approved by the chain of command and covered by legal opinions initiated in the White House. In the aftermath of Abu Ghraib, the military reasserted its ban on the harsh methods prohibited by its Army Field Manual on interrogation. The secret Justice Department memos that provided legal cover by trying to define torture out of existence had been withdrawn. Then in December 2004, the newly re-elected president nominated Alberto Gonzalez, one of the War Council's five lawyers, to be Attorney General of the United States.
Can U.S. personnel legally engage in torture under any circumstances?
I suppose without... I don't believe so, but I'd want to get back to you on that and make sure that I don't provide a misleading answer. But I think the answer to that...
But mislead he did. Soon after Gonzalez was sworn in, the Justice Department secretly issued a new legal opinion renewing the CIA's Golden Shield to use the harsh tactics the president called alternative interrogation techniques. It had been more than 3 years since the first prisoners arrived in Guantanamo.
Dick Cheney.
We got a brand new facility down in Guantanamo. We spent a lot of money to build it. They're very well treated down there. They're living in the tropics. They're well fed. They've got everything they could possibly want. There isn't any other nation in the world that would treat people who were determined to kill Americans the way we're treating these people.
Clive Stafford Smith, Director, Reprieve.
None of them been charged with a crime. None of them been convicted of a crime, for the most part aren't guilty of a crime. And yet they're being held in these maximum security prisons, which if I made you do it for a week, it would drive you crazy. And we pretend like this is civilized, and it is utterly uncivilized.
After 2 years of interrogations, with no end in sight, Bishr al-Rawi refused to be questioned again. He was labeled non-compliant and moved to Camp 5, where prisoners were confined alone at least 22 hours a day. They were not in solitary confinement, the Pentagon insisted, but simply held in single-occupancy cells.
And they just leave you there in a cell, concrete cell, with nothing. And you're shivering. You know, like you can't take it for an hour or two, maybe a day. You sleep and you're shivering. The pictures don't show you what the authorities are actually doing there.
Al-Rawi's cell was lit 24 hours a day. At times, the air conditioning was turned off, and he was left to swelter in the tropical heat. At others, it was set to blow frigid air, and as punishment, his jumpsuit was taken away. After a year in solitary, Al-Rawi began incessantly pacing back and forth in the tiny cell, talking to himself, laughing maniacally.
You push him. You deprive him of his senses. You deprive him of his of life. And then the point could come when he will just flip. And then your mind will just say, that is it. I'm finished. I'm done.
His lawyers feared Al-Rawi was slipping into a madness that would be permanent. If that happened, it would be the terrible proof that even by the administration's narrow definition, he had been mentally tortured.
This debate is occurring because of the Supreme Court's ruling that said that we must conduct ourselves under the common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague. What does that mean? Outrages upon human dignity. That's a statement that is wide open to interpretation.
No trial has been set.
In 2006, the Supreme Court ruled that Guantanamo's detainees were entitled to the protections of the Geneva Conventions. One justice warned that violations of Common Article 3 are considered war crimes.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States.
But just weeks before the midterm elections, stampeded by the threat of looking weak on terrorism, Congress once again bowed to the administration's policy of cruelty.
It is a rare occasion when a president can sign a bill he knows will save American lives. I have that privilege this morning.
The new law stripped the courts of the power to hear cases based on Geneva. And in a provision that had been pushed hard by the vice president, it granted retroactive immunity to U.S. officials who might have carried out or ordered torture. In March 2004, after 832 days in U.S. custody, Shafiq Rasool had been flown home from Guantanamo. British authorities released him without charge. In January 2005, Mozambique was released. He had been in U.S. custody without being charged for more than 1,000 days. On March 30th, 2007, Bishr al-Rawi was once again trussed like an animal and hustled aboard a plane. This time he was headed home. He had been in U.S. custody 4 years, 4 months, and 22 days.
Things that are buried in your mind, they stick with you for long. You just can't forget it. You can't. It just stays with you, and it hurts you every day, every time you remember it.
At least 500 men have been freed from the offshore prison with no explanation for their years behind bars. More than 250 are still there, most of them in solitary confinement. Mohamedou Slahi is one who remains. In his seventh year at Guantanamo, no charges have been filed against him. In 2006, Abu Zubaydah was transferred from a CIA black site to the island prison. After almost 7 years in U.S. custody, no charges have been filed against him. In May 2008, Without explanation, the Pentagon dropped all charges against Mohammed al-Qahtani. He is, according to his lawyer, paranoid, incoherent, cracked. He remains in U.S. custody. On June 12, 2008, the Supreme Court once again rebuked the administration, ruling that Guantanamo's prisoners have the constitutional right to challenge their detention. None of the prisoners will be automatically or quickly released. But the White House will now have to answer for their treatment and its practices in U.S. federal courts.
I have become an old man here. Death in this situation is better than being alive and staying here without hope.
You've been listening to an audio adaptation of Torturing Democracy, produced by Sherry Jones of the National Security Archive. If you would like to view this film online, visit torturingdemocracy.org.
It was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. And when the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles, we're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried after the revolution. Prison doors swung open, mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now after the revolution. Debts were all forgiven in all the neo-colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees after the revolution. Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Solar panels were on the roof, trains upon the tracks. Organic food was in the markets. No GMOs upon the racks. And all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Bill Gates was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm after the revolution. political poets couldn't think of what to say. So they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11 home beneath the covers. And I learned how to play the accordion after the revolution.
This week in our reading of Power and Powerlessness, the 2006 book by Susan Rosenthal, we're going to conclude Chapter 12 that has dealt with a capitalist assault on working-class children, and we'll begin the final section of the book devoted to solutions to the problem of powerlessness. Where we left off last week, Rosenthal was debunking the propaganda about a youth crime wave. As you can see from the first part of the show this week, the crime wave is actually in government buildings and corporate boardrooms. Yet it is the schools that have been turned into prisons, providing training for the future role of convict or wage slave. In the preceding chapter, Rosenthal has referred to the work of the anti-school educator John Taylor Gatto, whose book, The Underground History of American Education, was read almost in its entirety on this program in the past. Gatto documented what is often described as the failure of the education system, that is, its failure to develop the intellect of students. Actually, that is its success, producing demoralized people resigned to regimentation, boredom, and following the orders of knaves and fools, perfectly equipped for the corporate world. This was by design. Gatto obtained policy documents written by the people who created the American system of mass compulsory schooling. They were quite candid in their writings regarding what they intended the system to accomplish. In recent years, rebellion against this crushing of curiosity has been medicalized, and a growing number of children who won't capitulate are prescribed psychoactive drugs, their parents threatened with child abuse charges when they refuse the so-called treatment. Teachers, too, have been reduced to assembly line workers, following a mind-destroying prescribed curriculum, which is memorized, regurgitated on standardized tests, then forgotten. We continue in Chapter 12 of Power and Powerlessness with the topic of child convicts. During the 1960s, schools and communities provided a variety of music, art, and athletic programs for young people. Since then, cuts to social programs have left many youngsters with no organized activities. As a result, 75% of teens report hanging out with their friends with nothing specific to do. No one thinks twice when adults hang out with their friends. However, teens are condemned for doing the same thing. When parents are working 2 and 3 jobs, peer acceptance becomes more important for young people. Instead of condemning the lack of social support for youngsters, politicians and the media condemn youth gangs and call for a crackdown on young people, including harsher penalties, trying youngsters as adults, and jailing them in adult prisons. Between 1994 and 2000, the rate of juvenile violent crimes fell 40% in the U.S., and the juvenile homicide rate fell 70%. Yet from 1990 to 1999, the number of incarcerated juveniles rose 74%. Juvenile detention centers are filled with children convicted of underage drinking and smoking, truancy, breaking curfew, running away, and other minor offenses that are illegal only for minors. The racism of the adult prison system extends to the youth prison system. Between 1988 and 1997, the rate of increase in detentions for black youth was more than double the rate of increase for white youth. In 1997, judges sent 27% of black delinquents to juvenile prisons compared with just 15% of white delinquents. Young people of color form 1/3 of the total youth population, and 2/3 of youngsters in criminal detention. A two-way conveyor belt runs between the foster care and prison systems. Dorothy Roberts observes, quote, "The prison system supplies children to the child welfare system when it incarcerates their parents. The child welfare system then supplies young adults to the prison system when it abandons them after years in foster care," close quote. Foster children form fewer than 2% of the general population, yet they make up 15% of all the children in detention. In some states, the rates are much higher. In Connecticut, 75% of youth in the state criminal justice system had been in foster care. In Illinois, 80% of adult prisoners were in foster care as children. All 50 states allow juveniles to be tried as adults. Young defendants are less likely to have adequate legal representation, with the result that youth sentences average 60% longer than adult sentences for the same crimes. In 1999, 12-year-old Lionel Tate killed his 6-year-old playmate while showing her wrestling moves he'd seen on television. He was tried as an adult and convicted of first-degree murder. When he was 13 years old, a Florida court sentenced him to life in prison. Young black males like Tate are 3 times more likely to be charged with violent crimes, 6 times more likely to be tried in adult court, and 7 times more likely to be sentenced to prison when they are tried as adults. Frightened, defenseless, subject to all manner of abuse, children in adult jails are up to 8 times more likely to kill themselves than those held in juvenile detention centers. Nothing condemns capitalism more than its barbaric treatment of children. The kids are all right. Children are the future. Despite efforts to drive a wedge between the generations, most adults think that helping kids get a good start in life is extremely important, more important than preventing crime. 75% of adults agree that, quote, "given enough help and attention, just about all kids can learn and succeed in school," close quote. 89% think that, quote, "given enough attention and the right kind of guidance, almost all teenagers can get back on track," close quote. This belief in youngsters runs counter to social policies that treat troubled youth as unmanageable and in need of harsh punishment. Young people deserve support and admiration. What society gives them instead is neglect and abuse. The powers that be fear the energy and moral indignation of youth. Young people who organize against injustice are maligned by the media and assaulted by police. Some are even killed as a warning to the rest. When 23-year-old Carlo Giuliani was murdered by police during a demonstration in Genoa, Italy, his father praised him. Quote, "Carlo was the exact opposite of what people have written about him. He was a boy of great generosity who was opposed to injustice. He read, studied, he discussed, and he protested for his ideas. He always cared about others. He always worked, if irregularly. He worked in the jobs that all young people are forced to take, in the black economy, without any security, without any rights. Carlo didn't accept the notion that 8 leaders of the world should decide the life and death of hundreds of thousands of people," close quote. In the story of the emperor who wore no clothes, the adults admired the emperor's invisible threads, while the child could see that he was stark naked. When the child spoke up, the adults were faced with a choice. Should they confront the emperor or force the child to conform? The next chapter explains why it is necessary to take sides. Summary. A society that oppresses the majority must also oppress its children. Children question everything and do not tolerate injustice. To maintain the status quo, the potential of youth to build a better world must be suppressed. Schools demand subservience to prepare most youngsters for low-wage work. Youth who rebel against their oppression are slandered by the media, torn from their families, drugged by doctors, brutalized by authorities, and incarcerated by the state. despite efforts to drive a wedge between the generations, belief in the potential of youth remains strong and provides hope for the future. And that concludes Chapter 12 and Part 3 of Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Next, we'll begin the final section of the book, Part 4, What Will It Take? How will we find a way out? We walk and talk with Babylon's mouth, Faith Nolan. In her song, How Will We Find a Way Out?, Faith Nolan wonders how we can create a new society when every aspect of our lives is shaped by the old one. The answer to this question lies in the question itself. Those who are completely dominated do not question the way things are. Questioning reveals a desire for change. The last part of this book shows how the elements of a new society exist within the old, creating pressure for change. At some point in their development, all species face problems that they must solve or they will perish. The most important question humanity faces today is the question of power. Who will control society? The minority or the majority? Part 4 explains how humanity can break free of capitalism and create a classless society based on equality, reciprocity, and cooperation. Chapter 13, Decide Which Side You're On, explains why we must take sides. Chapter 14, Seize the Power, shows how the working class could take control of society. Chapter 15, Beware the Middle Ground, reveals the danger of compromise. Chapter 16, Claim the Surplus, outlines the prospect of producing for human need. Chapter 13, Decide Which Side You're On. I don't believe it's possible to be neutral. The world is already moving in certain directions. Wars are going on. Children are starving. And to be neutral, to not take a stand in a situation like that, is to collaborate with whatever is going on, to allow it to happen. Howard Zinn. Why do we have to take sides? Wouldn't everyone benefit from an end to famine, preventable disease, pollution, and war? It's a lovely thought. However, class divisions exist because the two major classes have conflicting goals. The prime directive of the capitalist class is to seize the surplus at the expense of the working class, which can resist only by raising its own demand, share. Because it is impossible to seize the surplus and to share it at the same time, only one class can rule. Which one should it be? This chapter explores which class best represents the interests of humanity. Defining class. 40% of Americans think that it's easier to move up the class ladder now than it was 30 years ago. America is described as the land of opportunity, where people can better themselves if they try hard enough. In reality, fewer American families improved their conditions over the 1980s compared with the 1970s, and even fewer moved up during the 1990s. Between 1980 and 2002, the proportion of U.S. income earned by 90% of the population fell, while the share going to the top 0.1% more than doubled. Stories of individual success support the myth of upward mobility. A newspaper article titled McJob Can Lead to Career, McDonald's Employee Worked His Way Up, highlights Glenn Stevens, a top McDonald's executive who started off as a restaurant worker. The message is that entry-level jobs can lead to professional careers for those with the right stuff. Lotteries use the same logic. Someone has to win, why not you? In reality, corporations hire few executives, and even fewer people win lotteries. Nevertheless, the lure of success draws many into a game that enriches only a few. No matter how hard people work, a hierarchical society cannot provide a decent life for all. A 2005 investigation by the New York Times concluded, "Class is still a powerful force in American life. Over the past three decades, it has come to play a greater, not lesser, role in important ways. Those who insist that you can't reduce everything to class fail to understand how profoundly class affects every aspect of life, from birth to death. Health and lifespan decline as you go down the social ladder. Raising children is much easier with nannies, maids, and regular vacations. Retirement with health and wealth is very different from retirement with neither. The poor are hit harder by economic recessions and natural disasters. Earthquakes, hurricanes, and tidal waves that devastate trailer parks spare the sturdy homes of the wealthy. The existence of inequality cannot be disputed. However, what class means is highly disputed. In the United States, those who are neither very rich nor very poor are generally assumed to be middle class. According to author Lillian Rubin, all the talk about the middle class serves to obscure class realities rather than to clarify them. To acknowledge the existence of a working class challenges the long-held American fiction that this nation has conquered the invidious distinction of class. Instead, the political rhetoric supports and strengthens the myth that we are a classless society. Close quote. Class is commonly defined by a person's income, wealth, education, and occupation. However, these categories are not useful. Unionized factory workers can make more money than middle-class professionals. Top athletes can acquire larger fortunes than Pentagon generals, and skilled workers can be more educated than small business owners. A gardener could be a unionized worker or own a business, and the category of white collar includes the filing clerk and the chartered accountant. Many people think that class is too complicated to define. It doesn't have to be. Human beings are a social species, and class is a social relationship. Individual characteristics, like a person's income, wealth, education, and occupation, tell us nothing about a person's relationship to others and to society. We need a social definition of class. Historically, people have created different social arrangements to secure the necessities of life and raise the next generation. In pre-class, egalitarian societies, everyone shared the work. Sharing the work means sharing the decisions about what will be done, how it will be done, and who will benefit. In class societies, most people work, and a few live off their labor. The people at the top make the decisions, and everyone else carries them out. The questions of work and power are central to both social arrangements. A social-based definition of class would measure two variables: the control that people have over their work and the control that they have over other people's work. Using this criteria, we can divide modern society into three classes: the class that rules, the capitalist class; the class that obeys, the working class; and the class in the middle class. The following sections flesh out these definitions. And I've been reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. We'll continue with the reading next week. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Over the coming weeks, we'll be reading the book together, and at the end, I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking her my questions and yours. So if you have questions and comments about the book you'd like her to respond to during the interview, please email them to me at the email link on the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where MP3 downloads of this and all previous episodes are also available. Down like an